Welcome to Why We Collect,
a podcast by Bright Archives.
Hello, everyone. I'm Catherine Barbera.
And I'm David Bernabo.
Today, we're talking with Adil Mansour.
My name is Adil Mansour. I use he, him, his pronouns. I'm a theater director and educator, and I've been living in Pittsburgh since 2010.
And specifically, we're going to be talking about a theater piece that Adil made called Amigon.
So I even start the show explaining the title. Amigon is a word I've made up, and you cannot mispronounce it, I promise. Amigon is a combination of the words, the Urdu word for mom, which is Ami, and the Greek tragedy Antigone, Amigon. But people say Amigani, am I gone? It's all welcome.
We are pretty interested in this piece because there are aspects of archives, there are aspects of oral history, and those two things are kind of what we're interested in.
I'd never seen any of Adil's work before. He was generous enough to provide a link so that we could watch his new show, Amigon, ahead of this interview. And it's absolutely lovely. I'm so excited for this conversation to hear about his process, why he chose to structure the show the way he did, but also kind of the emotional journey that he took as he put it all together.
And full disclosure, I've known Adil since 2013. We started working on dance pieces with choreographer Marie Ramalia. And most recently in February, we worked on a new piece with Marie. So I've been talking to Adil a lot over the past few weeks. And Adil is about to tour Amigon. And it's really the first piece I've seen where he is the writer, director, co-director, and the star of the show, along with recordings of his mother.
Yeah, there's a lot of emotion in it. It's heavy, but not necessarily in a bad way. I didn't walk away feeling bad about the world, about life. Instead, I felt like it opened up aspects of being human that were really interesting and complicated.
I think that's spot on. Well, let's talk to Adil.
Sounds great.
So I'm wondering how you would characterize this piece. Is it a play? Is it a monologue? What is it?
Good question, and still hard to answer somehow after working on it for 5 years. It's technically a play. I'm a theater artist, so I make theater, and so, you know, it's presented as a piece of theater. But it's not like five actors and a living room drama, and it's, you know, it's not that same kind of play. Other words that you might use to describe it are lecture performance or contemporary performance or performance art, or, you know, mama's boy theater kid talk crying about his mom in public. It's like another way you might describe it.
Could you tell us a little bit about how the project arose and then kind of what the project is?
Totally. Amigon is a solo performance created and performed by me, Adil. It's an adaptation of Antigone, the Greek tragedy, as an apology to and from my mom. And so this 2,000-year-old Greek tragedy, if folks have read it, it starts at the end of a war. Two brothers have taken each other's lives. And the play follows their sister working to bury one of those brothers against the king's decree. She knows that it will cost her life. So in Antigone's decision to bury her brother, knowing that it will get her killed, I see a radical feminist warrior, like an anti-state badass. And I also see someone who prioritizes the afterlife over being alive. In that binary, I begin to see versions of my mom. My mom's a social worker, a single mother, a devout Muslim who discovered my queerness on Google. I'm Googleably gay. And prays for me, you know, prays for me sunset to sunrise to come back to her understanding of Allah, of Islam. I spent much of my 20s and early 30s feeling like that meant I'd already died in her eyes, if you're focused on my afterlife so much. But in my late 30s, I'm like, nah, it's a form of care, right? Like what she's doing, this is how she knows how to take care of me. And so how do I be alive with her? Well, I love making plays. What if I asked her to make a play with me? What if she and I work on Antigone together and we translate it and adapt it? And she's a dramaturg, I'm a director, and we filter it through our experiences And at some point, I thought we'd make like a script for actors and, you know, make a play. It was my thesis pitch at one point in school. And that's not what happened. That was never what was interesting. What was always interesting was my mom's voice, was the way she thought about this Greek tragedy. And so it morphed into a show about, I sit on stage quite simply. It's almost like a live podcast of sorts. I play the audio from my mom and then I deal with it. That's the play.
Oh, that's great. And I think one aspect that we're super interested in is all the stuff that you brought to the play. There's family photos, objects. Maybe some of those things aren't from your family. But if we could think about maybe the archival piece, how did you choose objects to go in the performance?
Sure. A place to start would be the photographs. There's a lot of photographs in the show. And part of it is they're just really sweet. It's like really fun to look at them. And I'm so grateful I'm an 80s baby. So like I have photo albums and I have these pictures that I think maybe don't totally exist now. Like I don't have to go through a Facebook profile to find my baby pictures. So I feel really lucky. And I was a yearbook kid. And so I've always loved that stuff. And then part of it is that the photos are complicated. So my mom started wearing the hijab in the late 90s, meaning the photos from my kid time are photos in which she's not veiled. And so they're not photos I can share publicly. And I had to come up with ways to share them in the show. And that, you know, might sound like a constraint at first of sorts, but for me actually has turned into like one of my like favorite parts of the show, all the different ways in which I can still share, but hide or cover. And honestly, like thinking about veil as revealing has become really juicy and exciting. So one, I just like love the photos. I'm an adorable kid. This is real. And then two, they like served like, oh, how this thing is complicated. I can't pull it out at a party. I can't just show it to a group of people. How do I share it? How do I share my Muslimness? How do I share, like, I don't think it's any less than anybody else's anything. So how do I present it fully while acknowledging the reality of it?
And I guess sticking with the photos, how did you cover them up?
So we do it a few different ways. One is just like, I took the photos and I put like green paper on top of my mom's face. And then I sent them to the media artist and then they green screened embroidered fabric onto the images. And the fabric means all kinds of things. The simplest thing is like, I was a gay kid in the 90s with a bunch of scarves in the house. Like, I loved wearing them. Like, so that's what that's about. And then there are these like, trying to like not spoil parts of the show as well. So they're very special. There's this like moment where I worked with an embroidery artist to craft like really, really special photograph objects that just like mean the world to me, both as like their original image and now what they've been turned into.
And then with the photos, are these photos that you have, like that you own, or did you, when you visited your mother, get more photos?
There's a photo album that I have that is in my possession. And I like probably in like the fifth grade took it and like made it look like a magazine. Like there's like all these photos are arranged and there's like little like handwritten labels that I've like labeled and captioned all over the album. And like, and it's chronological. So there's photos of like my mom pregnant with me and it's like, I'm coming. And he's like, I probably just learned what it meant to be pregnant. You know, like I'm like just understanding. And so I have that object and it's so special. It's funny. I'm literally coming to I just handed that object to my dear friend Nicole, who's going to digitize all the images for me. I literally was there moments before I came to join you all. So that's one album. And then I was gifted a ton more photos after my father passed. He passed a decade ago, almost exactly. And when I visited my uncle, his brother, he had this treasure trove of just boxes and boxes of photos. And what I didn't, you know, my uncle is 70 plus, and somehow I only a year ago learned that he was a photographer and like has all these beautiful cameras and like really cares about the photos he's taken. It's not something I got to know until I sat with him and saw these photos that he's taken of me and my dad from the moment I was born. And they're so special. None of those are in the show because they came after, and they're more my they're more about my father than my mom. But yeah, I love my photos.
I watched Amigan and loved it for multiple reasons. You know, it's a very complex show presented in a fairly simple way, which is, it's lovely. It's just lovely. But one of the things I was really struck by, you know, we do a lot of oral history in our work. And when you approach it from like a, when you approach oral history from like a professional perspective, you try to like, you don't avoid the messy bits, but you try to like solve them or find ways to get around them or come up with standards or procedures that kind of guide you through the messy parts of doing an interview. Whereas with this show, I feel like you embraced all of that, the complications behind translation and transcription and kind of layers of meaning that are missed when you send things through processes like that. I wonder if you can talk just a little bit about embracing that messiness, whether that was an intentional decision, something that just happened, and then how you came up with a way to present it so simply on stage. That's kind of a long question, so I can rephrase if needed, but...
No, I appreciate that. I feel very seen in a good way. That's nice. Some ways I think about that. One, just welcoming the messiness at the time of recording. I was so nervous, but I tried really hard to be like, okay, I have this inkling that me and my mom talking about this play will open things up. I don't know. I don't know what it'll open up. I don't know where it'll go, but I think it could go somewhere. And I thought we would find the most like juicy conversation around King Creon and Antigone, which is what, when people think of this play, that's what they think. That's the conflict you think of, is that the central conflict. But really, it's the first scene that my mom just like sank into. And it was full of surprise. And like part of the way to structure the messiness for me in that moment was like, you know, we had a whole, the first session, I've done 3 weekend sessions with my mom, each probably with about 6 hours or so of recording. So it's probably around 20 hours of tape. A lot of it is completely unrelated to what we're talking about. Like, I just was, like, really trying to tell myself, just let her go wherever she goes. And, like, whatever she wants to talk about, think of it as a gift. And, like, it is what it is. And I tried really hard to not be like, we have to talk about Ismene. Like, that's what we must do. Like, I was trying to really free myself. And I was lucky that I started the recording at a time where I didn't know what the show would be about. There was no like end result in mind. There wasn't even a form, really. I thought it'd be with 2 actors. Like, I thought it'd be a different thing, which is maybe a real gift, like, because I wasn't coming in with any kind of pre-assumed form. I just like, go be with your mom. Like, how lucky. My therapist said that I'm so lucky that I have a mom who is still curious. I was like, I am. And like, let's really lean into that. And then, like, this stuff you're really picking up on around translation, transliteration, that, like, I'm using Sonic's AI to transcribe, but it can't translate into one of the 3 languages my mom uses, the central language our conversation's in. And I really didn't want my mom to feel trapped in English. Like, that's just never gonna do what it needs to do. And it sets the powers wrong, right? Like, if my mom and I are conversing in English, I'm suddenly in power. And there's just, like, nothing we can do about that. And that's not the point of this. So it's like, how do we meet? And so I was at first really self-conscious about those things and really anxious that, like, well, this is filtered through my lens. It's like morally really thick. Like, there could be, like, you could really screw this up. And I'm not saying that I didn't. Like, I really welcome the possibility of someone finding rigorous critique, for sure. But what I did do, and I feel good about, I worked with a dramaturg who's a filmmaker. And they were born in Karachi and lived there for a long time and attended school there and now live in Canada and are queer and share a lot of experiences with my mom in that, like, Karachi, they went to a woman's school. They can understand my mom's experience, but then also have a Western lens. So they were this wonderful person that I could be like, what do I do? Like, how do I move through this? And they really helped me because they also work in translation and in film and often working with people who are currently living in Pakistan. So they could understand it with a sensitivity. Like one guiding principle always, I don't know if this answers your question, but was like, how do I make a show that my mom would really struggle to hate? That like every time that she could not dismiss it because of anything else other than the really hard stuff. And so I was like, how do I respect every story at the umpteenth level? And so that kept being the guiding light. Or even like, okay, we have to pick from three fabrics. Which one would she like the most? So every decision was made with like, what would she be the most inspired by?
You mentioned you started taping before you knew what this would be. Did you alter how you taped or like where you put the microphone as this became like, oh, this the piece is going to use the tapes?
I always knew that I was interested in the archive. Like I was interested in the thing we were recording and I was interested in capturing my mom and I's conversation. That part I knew. And I knew that I had an inkling that I wanted to figure out how I could perform dramaturgy. And what I mean by that is like when someone says dramaturgy or the dramaturgical process, that's often the like behind the scenes, the rehearsal, how we talk about a text. It's English class, right? It's like if you're like that kid in sophomore year and you like love your English class, it's that feeling. And that is why I do theater, is that feeling. But I don't think I often get to see that feeling on stage. Like by the time the thing is on stage, something else has happened to it. I was like, how do I want that feeling? And so those were like early desires and research questions about the form. But I genuinely thought, like if I had to guess a form at that point, I thought there'd be two actors playing Antigone and all the conflicting people in her life. So there's a person playing Antigone and a person playing her sister, her fiance, Creon, Creon's wife, like all... I can't remember her name. It's okay. All the people. And that the show would then be cradled with recordings from me and my mom. And that at some point, the actors would maybe delve into like saying what we had said. I never thought I would be in it. But I knew the recordings had to be good. And luckily, when I went to grad school for directing, the other director in my program, Eben Hoffer, wonderful artist, director, human, comes from sound design background. And so they helped me like buy the best of the best recorders. And that's why it's like wearing that furry hat and like the windscreen. I learned what it is. And so I was like set up for success in that way. So, yeah.
Cool. Did you have to edit around anything weird, like someone thumping the table or?
So I tried really hard to not edit anything internally, like really specific, like never editing out pauses, thumping, anything. And it's this funny thing where, we've done a bunch of versions of this show, and the team has stayed pretty much the same throughout the last 5 years. And the last version was like a little bit higher stakes for all kinds of reasons. And beautifully, the sound designer removed a truck outside the window. And I was like performing with it. And I immediately was like, oh no, I need the truck back. Like, it's like, I need it back. So now we have to work to figure out how to like get the original on. Like, we. We'd like hunt for it. It's totally, you know, a welcome challenge. But my mom even refers to it. Oh, there's a truck outside. But if you don't hear the thunk, it's like, well, what is she talking about? So I tried to not alter the text in any way, simply select pieces that were effective for what we were making.
Why did you use that approach? Like, why was that so important to you, retaining all of the aspects of the original recording?
Because I didn't want anyone to be able to say that I manipulated what my mom was saying to me. I needed it to be completely and fully her voice. And I think the way we pause before we say something tells us a lot about intention. And you hear it in the tapes. You hear my mom take in pauses that are full of serenity, pauses that are full of anger. And I didn't want to sanitize any of those things. I will also say, though, I have so much power in the thing I'm making, right? Like I have 20 hours of audio, and I selected, what, maybe 20 minutes? A tenth? Meaning 90% of what my mom said in this very specific context isn't shared. And she could have said anything. That power is so enormous. If I were to edit and manipulate further, it just feels like not tenable. Like it's just like not the project anymore.
As you were preparing to do the first session, did you look at any particular resources? Like, were you Googling, how do I interview my mom? You know, things like that. How to do an oral history?
So I'm a teacher. And so I came at it from like a teacher director background, and I'm a theater director. My job is to ask good questions, generative questions, delicious questions, simple questions. I didn't specifically look at oral history stuff, but I have a philosophy of the kinds of questions I want to ask already. I teach asking questions, right? Like when I think about a class, if I'm teaching a class, I'm uninterested in asking a question that I already know the answer to. If I can just Google it, I'll just do that. So I would never ask a student, what year was this play written? I don't care. Who cares? Why is it useful to know that this play was written in the 80s? What happens if we know that this play was written inside of the Reagan administration? What does it do to the play? That is so much more important than someone saying 1988. Like, you know, like I can look that up. That is like, I didn't want to ask my mom questions that I already know the answer to. I want to set her up to be in a place where she can just fully open, like fully answer in authentic ways that are exciting and surprising even to her. When you're asking questions about scripts in a rehearsal, that's also the goal. Like you want to ask questions, relatively simple questions of like, why do you think she did this? What are the barriers in her way from preventing her? Like what's preventing Ismene from burying her brother? Right? We know she doesn't bury her brother. What prevents her? And that should open up a ton of things. What would prevent you? What would prevent your sister? And all of a sudden you just like hopefully encourage more and more. With other rooms, with every other room, I can lean on like camp counselor vibes. I do community agreements and I do all those things. And I even make a joke about this on the show. Like I asked my mom, should we do community agreements? And she was like, no, what? It's my house. The agreements, I do whatever I want here. Like I am your mother. I was like, oh yeah, that correct. We found a way to approach it with humor. Which really helped.
And for the listeners, how do you define community agreements?
Oh, totally. So often at the top of any collaboration, I would work with collaborators to write out agreements that we have that can help us all enter the space together. So that could be as simple as acknowledging how we all think about time. What does being on time mean to this group of people? Doesn't need to mean the same thing. It could be about cell phone usage, right? Or it could be about how food works, or it could be about an example is like oops and ouch, where if we're talking about something rigorous, it's possible I'll say something that could cause harm. How do we address it in the moment? And how do we then keep taking care of ourselves throughout the process?
Well, I'm wondering if someone wanted to have a similar conversation with their parents, you know, to open up things, do you have any advice for them?
Yeah. Like if the goal wasn't to make an artifact, if the goal was to have a conversation, go see some art. Like that's the advice. Go watch a play with someone you love and then make sure you have a car ride or an ice cream hang after to talk about the thing you witnessed. Go to a museum and ask the person you love what they're feeling when they're looking at the painting. You could curate, right? Like you could like be like, okay, I really want to engage my mom in conversations about her past. Can I find a movie that is talking about her culture in some way? Or like a movie that was a favorite, like even asking her like, what was your favorite movie as a kid and watching that together? Yeah, I think engaging in art with people you love is like, what a cool gift we have. And that's where I'd start.
What is it about art that allows for that kind of conversation?
One way to answer the question, it's efficient. Like, and maybe that's like a surprise, you know, like it's quick. You look at a painting and you can quickly talk about, oh, I like this because it reminds me of grandma's kitchen. Grandma's Kitchen? What happened in Grandma's Kitchen? And right? And then we're like on to beautiful stories about Grandma's Kitchen. Or I hate that she doesn't love him. And what a meanie. Like, why wouldn't she love him? And it's like, well, I don't love him either. Like, wait. There's an efficiency. There's also the ability, you hear it in the tape with my mom. We can put it on them instead. We can put it on the work, right? So my mom and I can rigorously talk about the relationship Ismene and Antigone have and how silence is functioning and how what the threat of their relationship is. And we can keep saying it's about them. We can feel that it's about us. I can see in my mom that she's sharing a truth, but in the moment, it can still be a truth about Ismene. And so I think that's a way to protect ourselves and to like enter something more gently and rigorously.
Yeah, I learned a lot. I took my dad to see Tony Conrad, the violinist, at the Kitchen in New York. 90 minutes of like one violin note, microtonal shifts with this film where parallel lines just kind of overlap each other back and forth for 90 minutes. We learned a lot about each other and our likes and dislikes, and he still holds it as the worst thing he's ever seen.
That's amazing.
I was curious, like, now that you have generated so much material, does the material have a life beyond the performance? Is it on a hard drive, neatly listed?
Exactly that. It is on the Google Drive and an external hard drive, intensely organized. It's also, oh my God, so I don't know that this is a thing I'd recommend, but here's the thing I did. You know, I recorded all the stuff. I came home. I didn't think about it for a week. And then I put those huge post-it notes all over my walls. And I pressed play and I hand transcribed all of the material. And I had like multiple colored pens and I was just like writing down everything I could catch. And then in a different color, writing down how I was feeling, what I thought I was feeling in the tape. And then writing down what I thought I was feeling listening to the tape. And then would timestamp everything. And then could be like, okay, this is this section. This is this section. This is this section. Oh, when did my mom say that thing about my uncle? I bet it would have been in this section. Then I can like find the handwritten part. It was easier because part of it was because Sonics was such a mess because of the Urdu part. I couldn't search Sonics for stuff. Like, I couldn't just do a quick, like, you know, because it didn't have the right words. And I had to hand, it only was able to transcribe 30% or so. So I had to hand do the rest, which is hundreds of hours. So I wasn't gonna do that for material that I wasn't thinking of using in the piece. So I needed a different way. So currently all the audio also exists on paper in a plastic bin underneath my bed. I did leave it hanging up in my room for like a while, which was not good. Like, I was just like swimming in these words. I was like, this cannot be good for anybody's mental health. And there are things that came up in the audio that are potential seeds for future projects, but I don't think ever with my mom again. Like, I think this did that. And it was a really wonderful experience. And there are things about it that are really hard for my family. And I'm trying really hard to like not make work about my family in this way for at least another project or so. Of course, the only thing I want to make about is about my dad, but like, I'm going to try to chill out. There are other things to make about.
If you feel comfortable talking about it, what were those difficult things for your family?
Oh, for sure. I mean, so all kinds of things were difficult. I mean, we're literally talking about the things we don't talk about. That's what the show is about. The show is about how difficult it is to talk. And here I am just like blabbing about it to the whole world. I'd been dreaming about the project in grad school. I went to this national performance conference. They do these 1-minute artist pitches. I was in school, and so it was a homework assignment for us to do a pitch. I was like, I don't have a show. And my mentor was like, you do, just make a 1-minute pitch, go do it. I was like, whatever. I wasn't even thinking about it, really. I just was one of 300 artists, right? It was just like, it was a homework assignment. I get up and I do the pitch. I'm like artist 148 or something. And I felt the room. I felt it. I felt that 1 minute felt amazing. And I was like, oh, fuck. Okay. Like, yeah, I need to do this. And the response was solid. And that is when the Theater Offensive and the Kelly Strohorn started getting excited about the work. And so it quickly went from a 1 minute homework assignment to a 1 month residency to a 4-year project to now a tour. And that scale shift has been hard on my family, right? Like I check in with them at every turn and it's like, where are we now? And there are certain things where, like, so because of quarantine and COVID, you know, there was an opportunity to, like, apply for something like Sundance with it because they were doing experimental stuff that wasn't film, that, you know, so, like, the Zoom version of the show could have maybe been submitted to that. And I was like, no, that's a scale I'm not interested in. It also means people could watch it without me having given consent to them or without them being in a room with me. So there's something about theater, like I'm learning a different thing about liveness. I have a certain amount of power if it's live. I'm the one that says, yes, you can play my mom's voice. So there's a care there that I get to control. And then my siblings just navigating like how they're gonna be in the work and then how they'll care for each other and my mom around the work and what that's meant. And it's changed. Maybe that's one way I can talk about it. I'm also trying to, you know, I'm trying to be sensitive. what was true in 2018 was not true in 2022. Because, people change. And how do we adjust and, like, really center that, like, okay, well, this is where we are now. It doesn't matter what happened in 2018. I need to, like, adjust the work so the person in 2022 feels completely taken care of. Because if I make this work full of love about my family and I leave with my family hating me, well, that wasn't successful. Like, that's not good.
There's this really lovely moment toward the beginning of the show where you're playing the first recording with your mom, and you're saying to each other, I can tell you about X, I can tell you about Y, and there's no explanation, there's no conversation about those, you know, X or Y items, it's just a list. And I'm wondering if you can tell us how you arrived at that format and that how it served as the opening to the show.
It's a theater game that I learned from Aaron Perry, who's a choreographer, educator, awesome human being in Pittsburgh, during my TAP, Transformative Arts Process project. It was a Heinz project a few years back. And I learned it in that. And I loved it so much that I have literally played it every single classroom artistic process ever since. Like, I play it constantly. I will have all of my students do it, any rehearsal process. And so it's just one of my favorite games. And that's why that's how my mom and I started the first session. And you hear us ease up. You hear how like stressed out both of us are at the top. And then part of it is like language. And I love when my mom just like slips into Urdu, right? She just changes the sentence. And I'm like, oh, so great. And we start laughing. And I like, we do keep playing. You don't get to hear the rest of it. It's so sweet. Like she's like, I can tell you about your first mustache. It's like one of them, which was so traumatizing, but it was so much fun to have her like poke fun of me. You know, 20 years later, we're like, I'm fine about my mustache. And it was the beginning of our process. So that's part of why it ended up at the beginning of the show. But then, you know, when we kind of zoomed back, my co-director, Liam Gable, who's been helping with the structure of the show, they were like, oh my God, it functions as like an intro to the characters. You're like, oh, this character likes cake. This character likes the blah, blah. Like, you learn like all these facts about us really fast. That was me snapping. Sorry.
Snaps are welcome.
I was like, I don't know what that So I was like, you know, that's like when you'd like find out like so-and-so went to school this place and they are who, like they're crabby or whatever. It's like this character intro that really worked.
I was wondering if this piece is still evolving.
It's a great question, if the piece is still evolving. Because, right, I'm still doing the process of translating with my mom. So what does that mean for the work? And I'm still, like, living, right, with, like, my mom, my siblings, and my partner. Like, all those relationships still exist. So I started performing versions of the work 2019. And up until 2022, those would keep changing based on what was happening in my life. And that could mean, oh, like, I no longer live with this person, or I no longer, or it's quarantine, right? Like, whatever, we would, like, reshape the work to make it make sense to that current moment, internally and globally. As of 2022, January, we are locking the show for a bunch of different reasons. Because now the show will have a very different life. It'll live, and I'll potentially be performing it 7 times a week for multiple weeks, and it'll be kind of a different marathon with it. And so we wanted to lock it for just the ability to keep touring. This weird thing was happening where I was, like, in certain ways, like, afraid to make decisions in my real life because they would, like, change the plot in some way. And I was like, well, that's weird. Like, I need to continue living my life. But it'd be like, but I love that part of the play, and I don't want to, like, in the play I talk about, like, oh, I'm about to move in with my partner. And then I have moved in. It's happened. But narratively, the potential of about to is really useful in that moment in the show. And so we're just going to leave it. We're going to freeze it in time in 2022. And in a certain way, it feels like I'm lying. Because, like, I do now live with this person that I'm going to say I'm about to live with. So it has stopped evolving in that way.
What, January 2022? Did the piece feel different? Did it feel less like autobiography and more like theater?
Interesting. So I haven't done it yet since. If we froze it in 2022 at that performance, the next time I'm going to perform it is April of 2024. And I do think it'll feel different. Another big thing that's changing, up until now, the quote-unquote script has been a 2-page lesson plan where I think about, like, all the audio and all the photos as if I'm teaching an art history class, which I do, right? Like, I teach theater history, at least. And I, like, show performance videos and I show, like, these things. And so those are set, like, they would be in a lesson plan. And the way I talk about it and around it morphs. But, you know, I have, like, a Felix Gonzalez Torres workshop that I do all the time, my favorite artist. And it, at this point, it's not memorized, but it's memorized, right? Or if you've ever been a college tour guide, like, all the buildings are the same. But the way you give the tour might shift. So that's how the play felt, which meant you needed the most generous stage manager ever. Because it's like their cues are different every time. It's like, do this when a deal feels a little sad. You know? At this scale, and really for my mental health, it's like, let's set it. Let's know it. Part of it was also, I never had enough actor rehearsal time. It's like an indie project, small scale, you know, so we just haven't had the time to have a full blown out actor time. And I'm not an actor. But the gift of this project in DC, I'll have, like, a real rehearsal process. In terms of time, it's all been real. I think it will feel more like theater than it ever has. And we're integrating more sound design at transitions than we've ever had. So we are moving towards a little bit more of a theatricality that I think will serve just the sustainability of the show.
So do you have upcoming performances?
Yes. So I get to present Amigon at the Woolly Mammoth Theater in Washington, D.C., and we're presenting the work from April 20th through May 12th. It's in association with Pittsburgh's Kelly Strayhorn, but the work will be in D.C. And then I get to take the show to Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, And I'll be performing from May 28th to June 23rd. And then after that, we're hoping to do a national tour of the work with Wooly and KST and take the work to all kinds of places and cities and dates TBD.
So with Why We Collect, we like to close out each episode with just a fun lightning round of questions so that we can get to know our guests a little better.
First question, favorite sandwich?
Chicken salad on a croissant.
Oh, yeah.
Always. It's just like...
We prepped this yesterday.
Like, anytime I go to a place that has chicken salad on the menu, I will order it no matter what as a test of the restaurant.
Favorite toy as a kid?
Oh, my God. Spirograph? The little plastic circle things you put the pencil in and you make circle. And also as an adult, same toy.
Last question, toilet paper up or down?
Honest, however the host does it. So like however Luke does it, like my boyfriend, or it's like whoever I'm around, because I grew up with like a washing situation, so we didn't really use toilet paper in the same way. It's a lot of information. So I try to respect the needs of other people's toilet paper.
That's a very now nice you know. Answer. Usually people are very opinionated. You know,
which I've learned the hard way.
Yeah. You go to somebody's house and they put the toilet paper up and you're a down person. You install it wrong. They're going to let you know.
I know. So I'm like, whatever you want. Just wash your hands.
Wash your hands. Yep, wash your hands. Thanks for listening to Why We Collect. This episode was produced by Catherine
and Dave, and Dave made all the music and sound design.
We hope you enjoyed the first episode of Why We Collect, and if you want to learn more about Adil's work, check out the show notes for the episode.
See you next time.